A Relatively Brief Reflection on Cognitive Dissonance by Ribbentype. This is a fanfiction for the Promised Neverland and is hosted on Archive of Our Own. This is a canon-compliant character study of Norman and focuses on his relationship between himself, Emma, and Dre. Here's a summary. There is no word in the English language to explain the gap between knowing something and understanding it. The world is too large and vast to experience in its entirety, and so when one wants to be as prepared as possible, there will always be some spaces where the concept, the idea of a thing, is there in a way that cannot become tangible until you are confronted with it. This is how Norman feels the first time he sees a dead body. To paraphrase, there are no certainties in life except death or taxes. Norman figured neither would be relevant to him for a very long time. He got it half right. And the author's notes are, I blanked out, and when I had woken up, this had been on my Google document. Completely unedited, and probably incredibly rambling, but an OT3 tag always deserves more content. Thank you, and I will start with A Relatively Brief Reflection on Cognitive Dissonance by Ribbentype. There is no word in the English language to explain the gap between knowing something and understanding it. The world is too large and vast to experience in its entirety, and so when one wants to be as prepared as possible, there will always be some spaces where the concept, the idea of the thing, is there in a way that cannot become tangible until you are confronted with it. This is how Norman feels the first time he sees a dead body. To paraphrase, there are no certainties in life except death or taxes. Norman figured neither would be relevant to him for a very long time. He got it half right. He doesn't read in the way Ray does, where he devours everything in front of him once and then twice and thrice again, until he knows the words and the feel of the spine and the way the book sounds when it slots back into place on the library shelves. But he does read. He is familiar with death, and the way he's familiar with anything else that exists beyond Gracefield's tree line. When he sees Connie's body, laying there, it is exactly the way it has been described. His heart seemed to stop for a beat, before ramping up its speed, to the point where it feels like a hummingbird trapped in the cage of his ribs. All of reality seems to collapse around this single point, as his brain tears itself to shreds trying to find anything, any semblance of logic, that can bridge the gap between the world that he, until this moment, believed in fully, and the world he is seeing in front of him. He is still thinking, even as he and Emma tear across the lawn with a ferocity he didn't know his physique was capable of producing. His side tears into stitches, and his labored and uneven breathing feels as loud as air raid sirens in the cool night air, as if it tears itself from his chest. Yes, it feels exactly how they described it in books. In the same way that a shadow is exactly the same form as the thing that casts it. The second time he feels this gap is at the Lambda facility. His childhood had been a happy one, relatively free of strife, until it hadn't been, and the worst fate to ever befall him had been a broken wrist. He had tripped, trying to follow Emma through the thicker and more wild parts of the forest, as she had hopped between rocks and across brackish gullies like she had been born for it. Maybe she had. It snapped clean, and didn't take him too long to recover. Even if it had, it wouldn't have mattered. In the mornings, Emma had held his plate still as he maneuvered bits of breakfast onto his fork one-handed. As evening fell, he returned to his room to find his bed pristinely made, and although no words were spoken on the subject, there was no doubt in his mind that it was Ray. He didn't ask. He didn't have to. The things they did to him at the Lambda facility hurt. On some days, the worst of his damage is self-inflicted, as he grits his teeth and locks his jaw hard enough that he'd swear there was a real chance that they'd both chatter. His head throbs with the strain of it as the day fades out and leads him into an uneasy, foggy sleep. Still, he is grateful. They wanted him for his brain, not his body. He sees the other Lambda children, mostly in passing, through the cold and sterile glass shell of their cage rooms. He sees what they do to them. He sees the way they draw out and enhance the abilities of those with superior physical prowess, and the voice and the way they scream, or sometimes he just sees the aftermath as he travels through the winding corridors. Because of course, how easy would it have been for it to be her? He knows whatever is happening to them is worse. He also knows by now that until it is him, it's a type of pain that he can never truly understand. He's content in this, seeing their suffering as shadows cast onto the cave wall, robbed of all substance. It isn't him. It isn't Emma. It isn't Ray. That's plenty. He orchestrates a prison break for the second time, not long after the first. The next time is possibly the worst. He knew that most of the other plantations weren't like Gracefield. He and his ilk had been free range. The countless others were just factory farming. When he sees them, his stomach twists like it's trying to turn itself inside out and begin digesting him from the inside. His hand twitches with the desperate need to reach for people who are no longer there, and so he just lets his fist sprawl tight, carving crescents into his own palms. He steals himself. The Lambda children are strong, but he has to be stronger if he wants to lead them. He doesn't have a choice. His first coherent thought is that it would be a stretch to call them human. His second coherent thought is how much he hates himself for thinking that. And he can already feel the sting of Emma's hand on his face as she put him back in his place for even daring to entertain the thought. He knows he isn't wrong. This is the one place where humans and demons are the same. In the way a demon needs a human brain to maintain form and personhood, humans need their brain nurtured to maintain theirs. I think, therefore, I am. Norman tries not to think about it as they pile food and medicine into their bags, leaving the factory nothing more than a pile of rubble in their wake. And then, somehow, things get better. It is not so much that he numbs himself to the horrors of the world he has been born into, but more like he cauterizes the wounds they've caused. Agonizing, at first, but ultimately the better choice, because while numbing a wound stops it from hurting, it doesn't help it to heal. He helps when he can. Over 2 years, he shoots up like a weed, and so does his rebellion. There is no word in the English language to explain the gap between knowing something and understanding it. When he was young, a year felt like an eternity. The time between birthdays stretched out in front of him and into the horizon, past the vanishing point, seemingly unsurmountable until suddenly the time has passed yet again. In the grand scheme of things, Norman knows that 2 years is like a drop in the bucket of water to a fully grown adult. In the lives of demons, many of whom had lived lives that have outlasted entire empires, 2 years might as well be a drop of water in a vast sea. But God, if it doesn't feel like he's been waiting so long. 2 years passed by in the blink of an eye, and Norman feels every agonizing minute of it. He is as cunning, as bold as ever, and he is so blinded by forward momentum that he almost manages to distract himself from the way he's changing. He learns. He studies. He watches. Plans. He reaches the only conclusion he can. It is us or it is them. For the cattle children. For Ray. For Emma. In his head, he never even tries to pretend it isn't about them. The only true freedom is a world without demons, and so this is the world he commits himself to building. And then, they find each other. He wants to say he found them, but he knows, understands, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that they just as much found him, because even if they didn't know the man they were seeking was him, he knew that they'd never give up as long as there was still blood in their bodies and thoughts in their head. They had found each other. Somehow, despite all the world's cruelties, they were given this. He stands across the room from her, crisp and polished in his vest and tie, his desk forming an island in the sea of space between them. Her contrast is stark. Her clothes hang rumpled and twisted in a way they only do when you've slept in them. He couldn't tell which stains were dirt and which stains were blood, but unmistakably, they were both there, painting a tapestry of her strife onto her shirt. Her eyes were deer and headlights wide, and the only patch of clean skin on her face was in the wake of her tear tracks. It's been a long time, hasn't it? Norman! And then, again, like she's going through the same thing they went through together with Connie. The reality she has lived is not the one that is true. Norman, is it really you? Her face and voice both crack about 2 seconds before his do. And fuck being Minerva. Fuck being God. Fuck whatever composure he's been cultivating to make himself feel older or taller or like anything else other than a fly in a spider's web. They melt into each other's arms and nothing else matters.
Ray is all Norman can get out before there's a well-deserved fist in his face. Oh boy, you're terrible. You didn't even say hi first. He laughs lightly as he watches Ray's face journey through every stage of grief in reverse, and then asks, "You got to see great things, didn't you?" "Yeah." His voice comes out thick and heavy as the tears start falling unashamedly. "Thanks for that." All Norman could think was, "Thanks for being my friend. Thanks for saving me. Thanks for taking the bullet. Thanks for not dying." Norman doesn't say anything. He doesn't ask anything. With the kind of raw and terrible strength that can only come from real experience, Norman feels himself yanked into Ray's embrace. Ray's head on his shoulder, dirt and tears staining the fabric of his shirt. Ray's hand on his neck, Emma's shoulder against his side. This is it. This is it. This is it. I'm glad you're here. Norman has read a lot of books, and although 2 certainties in life are death and taxes, it seems that literature has decided to slightly deviate from the formula. In the world of books, the only certainty is, for better or for worse, love. It's unavoidable, really. It's human nature to see the way people weave in and out of each other, the ripples they make as they to and fro. Go back far enough, and the entire history of mankind can be seen as a result of what people were willing to do for the things they loved. He thought he knew before, and maybe he did, but he never really understood. It is not an instant thing when he does, but instead it grows in him as this timid warmth that brings to a boil and spills out of him, bubbling and hot. Love. The books of poetry, the plays, the novels, they had all tried to tell him the way it felt, and he thought he understood. But God, God, he didn't. Maybe it was an issue of age, and he has just been far too young before. Maybe there is some truth to the old adage of absence making the heart grow fonder. Perhaps it was both. Either way, by the time that dinner rolls around, he is sure again. They have miles to go, and decisions with the weight of entire races on their shoulders. The contention will come. Tonight isn't for that. They eat dinner together. Seated at long rows of table in pristine parallel lines, like they did for so many years. "We love our bread," thinks Norman. "We love our butter. But most of all, we love..." His train of thought is cut off as someone's foot brushes against his own, with a touch that lingers for too long to be accidentally. Neither of the faces across the table from him point to a culprit, but shortly it stops mattering because another set of legs extends to intertwine. He laughs more and louder and with more truth to it than he has in months. That night, they push themselves until they drop. None of them are strangers to this way of living, but for once, the sensation comes without fear. Norman wakes up before either of them do, to no surprise. He's better rested, better fed, and his body not used to forcing sleep while fully clothed and perched awkwardly upright. How many times in the past 2 years have they ended up like this? Asleep in each other's embrace, without him. Maybe he should be jealous that the girl he's loved since he knew what the word meant, Emma, and the boy he's loved just as long, Ray, have a path that intertwines without him. But he can't bring himself to feel it outside of pure theory. He would die for them. In fact, he had tried to. Their happiness is his happiness, even when he isn't there to experience it with them. Right now, he's just lucky enough to have that chance. He's so warm on the places where their heads rest on his shoulders and the planes of their obliques press against him. They're clean now, bathed in the bathroom of his personal suite and donning fresh clothes one of the other children brought them. For the first time, he can see how bad the damage is. Their skin is pale and sallow, and the bags under their eyes are a sickly, bruise-like purple. His hands delicately swipe the loose strands of hair off of Emma's left side to see where the scar must be. It's an ugly thing, healed crudely from a lack of proper care. A gnarled red crater on the side of her head. It might just be the most beautiful thing he's ever seen. There's a gap, he thinks. for trees, for demons, for planets, for wars, for promises. 2 years may be trivial, but the space between being almost 12 and almost 14 is cavernous. He spends the early hours of that morning filling in the empty space, writing over 2 years of his own assumptions. The soft and unmarred childhood faces of Emma and Ray that had been living in his head bow out, and the new ones move in. There's a new sharpness to them, less like his where he's beginning to grow into himself, but more in the ways of spindly limbs and pronounced cheekbones. They have been fed, and they had been safe, but they had not been thriving. If their physique hadn't told them that, the way their eyes shone during dinner would have. There's also a gap in him. He doesn't realize how far he has strayed from the person he was until the two of them came back, pulling the taut stitches that held Minerva and Norman together with each other like Frankenstein's monster. For the longest time, both of them had felt like likes, two people he had pretended to be when it had suited him. Here, in the heavy darkness of his room, where the only sound is three sets of lungs breathing in tandem, he feels like his skin fits. He feels like he can be both. Things don't feel the way before. When he was younger, sometimes it seemed like nothing in the world mattered but them. They were his blinders, flanking him and blocking out everything else with just how largely they stood in his field of view. It's not like that anymore. He looks out into the microcosm of a world he'd built, and he sees it. All of it at its grandest possible scale. And it does matter. Not despite them, but because of them. In the world they came from, they were his refuge. The world they are going to will be his refuge for them. If it's for them, he knows he can do it. He knows. You have reached the end of a relatively brief reflection on cognitive dissonance by Ribbentype and narrated by yours truly, Mooney Writes. Thank you so much for listening, and please make sure to support not only myself, but the original author, and leave a kudos and comment on their fanfiction. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you enjoyed.